Die Übersetzung von Jans Stimme vom Deutschen ins Englische wurde mit einer KI erstellt.
Imagine you take public transit and at the start of your journey you don't even know if you will reach your destination because a drone might strike the bus or the trams. How does a city live when bus drivers have to learn how to outrun drones? When children are actually supposed to be evacuated, yet thousands stay anyway? And when for many people the day doesn't end in their own bedroom but in the basement? A few days ago I was in Kherson in the south of Ukraine and I met people who live exactly like this. One of them is named Maxim. He has been driving buses in the city for 17 years, and currently he sometimes no longer explains the timetable to his passengers, but rather how to survive a drone attack.
Yes, drone attacks have increased significantly recently. There is also constant artillery shelling, but artillery shelling is artillery shelling. We have gotten used to it to a certain extent. However, when drones attack, it's something else. We are equipped with electronic tracking devices, so it can be frightening when a signal appears on the screen and you realize a drone is circling nearby. We also wear additional protection, a helmet, and in moments like that you have to act quickly and try to get people to the nearest shelter as fast as possible.
How does a city and the residents endure something like this? That is what this episode is about.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello, I am Jan Jessen, head of politics at the NRZ and a war and crisis reporter for the Funke Mediengruppe. You can find my articles in the NRZ, the WAZ, the Berliner Morgenpost, the Hamburger Abendblatt, and on our online portals. A few days ago, I was traveling in Kherson, a city in the south of Ukraine. It is a city we have reported on many times here in this podcast. We will put a few of those episodes in the show notes for you. Kherson is unique because it was occupied by the Russians in 2022, was liberated in November 2022, and now faces the problem that it sits on the banks of the Dnipro River, which flows through Ukraine. The Russians are positioned on the opposite side of the river, and they have been shelling the city every single day since its liberation. They use artillery, mortars, and now, in recent months and years, primarily drones that they unleash into the city, small FPV drones, those small kamikaze drones that we have also discussed multiple times on this podcast. This results in injuries almost every day, and very often, unfortunately, deaths, which naturally makes life in the city highly problematic. Despite everything, 60,000 people still live in Kherson. Previously, the city had a population of around 250,000. Now it is 60,000. Many of them, however, are refugees from the occupied southern parts of the country. And yes, for these people, daily life is shaped by constant danger. When you travel through the city or when you drive into Kherson, you can clearly see how threatening the situation is. As you enter, you drive through netting tunnels that by now cover practically the entire city center. These are, as I said, a kind of tunnel with nets on the sides and on top, so that if drones strike, they do not hit the vehicles underneath. You also see soldiers standing everywhere across the city with rifles, with assault rifles, scanning the sky to see if drones are approaching. And then, of course, when the drones arrive, they try to shoot them down. And these drones, when they do attack, if the Russian drone pilots manage to get into the city, they attack absolutely everything. They don't just attack military targets, though perhaps they do in some places, but primarily civilians. People out for a walk, people carrying their groceries, children playing, or even private vehicles, buses, ambulances, and other emergency vehicles, like those belonging to the fire department. This makes things incredibly difficult. When we drove into the city this past February, for the first time, we had to tape over our vests, the ones with our press badges, so we wouldn't become targets for Russian drone pilots, who are reportedly actively hunting journalists. During our last visit a few days ago, we also visited a bus depot in Kherson. It smelled of oil and welding smoke. We saw mechanics working on damaged vehicles. And we spoke with Vadim Melnik, the director of the Kherson Transit Authority. He told us how precarious the situation is and gave us a short tour. He showed us an ambulance that was completely destroyed, inside of which a patient had died. That's what he told us. A drone had crashed right through the roof. You see a lot of these vehicles. It's not just transit buses standing there, but other vehicles as well. And many of them were damaged. The windshields were shattered and so on. You could see that these vehicles go through a lot. And then we met Maxim. He was standing in front of an old man bus, wearing only a shrapnel vest. In the driver's cabin of the bus, there was a helmet, and next to it, a box with loose change.
Hello, my name is Maxim, and I am a bus driver for public transit in Kherson. I have been doing this job for over 17 years, but in the last 5 years, the situation significantly got worse due to Russian military aggression. Nevertheless, we keep going and continue our work.
This, nevertheless, is something you hear often in Kherson. It doesn't sound melodramatic here. It sounds like a pragmatic choice made under duress. Vadim, the head of the transit authority, told me that buses are frequently targeted and that the bus drivers suffer from it. By now, 8 drivers have been injured in attacks and 2 of them died. So, of course, I asked Maxim why he doesn't just quit and why he keeps doing this life-threatening job. He told me,
because our parents and children still live here, they need our support. Leaving is not that easy. Yes, it is dangerous here, but unfortunately, in other regions, there is often no opportunity to start a new life. That is why we continue to live and work here, supporting each other and sticking together.
That is a crucial point. When you travel around Kherson and observe life there, you naturally ask yourself, why are people still going shopping? Why are they trying to maintain a normal life? Why don't they just flee this city, which has become one of the most dangerous places in Ukraine? The reality is, for one thing, their families live there, they need the work, and they cannot afford a life outside of Kherson. Many own their own homes or apartments, and if they were to leave Kherson and move to, say, Kiev or some other Western Ukrainian city, they would lose their livelihood on one hand, and on the other, they would have to pay far more for daily expenses than they do in Kherson. Most people simply cannot afford that. The buses in Kherson are therefore far more than just standard public transit. They are a lifeline of infrastructure. We got onto the bus with Maxim. He sat down in the driver's seat with his helmet beside him, as mentioned. He was wearing a protective vest, admittedly an unusual sight, a bus driver in a shrapnel vest with a helmet next to him. On the very morning we arrived in Kherson, a young man had died when a bus was attacked by a Russian drone pilot. Because of that, I naturally expected the bus to be completely empty, with maybe 1 or 2 people inside. But no, from stop to stop, the bus filled up until it was absolutely packed. A bus ride in Kherson costs 10 hryvnia, which is roughly 20 cents, so it's entirely affordable. But as I said, it was surprising to see the bus so full, despite the mortal danger. People were commuting to work, others were on their way to the hospital. I spoke with 2 elderly ladies who said they had to go to a hospital in the so-called red zone, the area of the city that repeatedly suffers from very heavy attacks. This too is part of the daily reality in Kherson. Hospitals are constantly attacked, medical and nursing staff are killed or wounded, and patients lose their lives. We once did a story that we also discussed here on the podcast inside the forensic department in Kherson. We went into the morgue and looked around. It contained victims of Russian attacks who had died in various explosions. Shortly after our visit, that very morgue was completely destroyed in another Russian strike. These are definitively not legitimate targets of war or military objectives. It is pure terror against the civilian population of Kherson. During the ride, you could clearly feel the tension. On one hand, there were people talking quite animatedly. On the other hand, there were people who looked visibly relieved when their journey ended. You could tell that, despite the routine they live in, they know they are in mortal danger every single day and on every single ride. Outside, you could also see people walking around, standing at bus stops or shopping, and their eyes would repeatedly scan the sky with a sense of anxiety. You could tell they were constantly checking the sky for anything approaching so they could get to safety. This route also passes through the netting tunnels I mentioned earlier. They cannot prevent drones from exploding, but they reduce the impact of the blasts. I have seen this a few times now in Ukraine. You can see where a drone has struck the top of the net. They have contact fuses, meaning as soon as they hit something, they explode. The same happens with the nets. It tears tears a large hole in the netting above, but it mitigates the force of the explosion. If a drone hits a vehicle directly, the people inside usually die or are at least severely wounded. We have witnessed this a few times ourselves. For instance, in October of last year, we were traveling in Kramatorsk and learned that two of our colleagues had been killed. They wanted to do a story about an attacked bus stop and were targeted themselves by a Russian Lancet drone. The vehicle was completely destroyed in the strike, and both of them lost their lives. So these tunnels, these nets, they do help, but it is still a jarring sight to see an entire city having to be protected this way because these drones attack constantly. Maxim says that the people know exactly what his work means to them.
Most people do, yes, of course. They support us, and we receive a lot of gratitude because we help keep the city running. We take risks, and our passengers take risks too, but people still need transportation to get to work, and most importantly, to get to the hospital. Therefore, our work is very important.
Bus travel in Kherson is no longer just a daily routine. It is a piece of infrastructure that keeps this city alive. Anyone who has to get to work, to the hospital, or to relatives relies on these buses and on the drivers. Alongside Maxim, there are a total of 59 people, including a few women, who get into these buses and drive every day. But as I said, every journey can turn into a hazard. Oleksandr Prokudin, the governor of the Kherson region, describes just how massive the threat in Kherson has become.
Today, the greatest threats to Kherson region comes from Russians UAVs. We face up to 5,500 drone attacks every week, hunting civilians, children, ambulances, and rescue teams. They target older people on their way to the market, children out for a walk, and paramedics responding to emergency calls. Now, Russian drone operators do not care who ends up in their sights.
That is the fundamental difference between artillery shelling and these drone attacks. When we first started reporting on the war in Ukraine, we encountered drones mostly as reconnaissance drones. Back then, you had to keep an eye out, because as soon as a reconnaissance drone was spotted, it meant it was directing enemy or Russian artillery. Even so, artillery fire is very localized. Once a shell is fired, it lands somewhere, but it cannot be adjusted mid-flight. With drones, it's completely different. Drones fly, the pilot identifies a target below, and can steer the drone precisely into that target, regardless of whether you run away from it or not. A drone attack is far more targeted than an artillery or mortar strike. This is what has drastically altered daily life in Kherson and made it highly dangerous. Maxim mentioned earlier that he has a detector on board. We had one with us this time as well. A drone detector is an instrument that looks a bit like a tablet with three antennas. It's a plastic device with a screen, and the idea is that it scans for and picks up the signals of approaching drones. However, this only works for radio-controlled drones. It doesn't work for fiber-optic guided drones, which are increasingly appearing on the battlefield and in cities. But for radio-controlled drones, this device catches the radio and video signals of the incoming drone. First, you hear a beeping sound that accelerates the closer the drone gets. Then suddenly, the screen displays exactly what the approaching drone sees. On one hand, seeing that image appear on the detector and realizing a drone is somewhere nearby is genuinely terrifying. On the other hand, it offers a small measure of security. If you see your own vehicle on the screen, you should immediately park and get out of the car as fast as possible. That is exactly what Maxim describes. He told me what happens when the detector sounds the alarm.
Yes, about a year ago, or rather a bit more than a year ago, on May 20th, a drone dropped an explosive device near the bus. What saved us was the alarm from the detector. I saw that the drone was in an attack position, so I accelerated slightly. The drop landed near the rear wheel, right next to the bus. And fortunately, it didn't hit us directly.
Maxim mentioned this pretty casually, but it was a situation that could have ended horribly. When a drone like that hits, they carry an explosive payload of up to 9 kilograms. That is substantial and causes massive damage. And yes, as I said, people are injured every day in Kherson and very often killed. I remember shortly after our visit, on July 1st, there was a report from Kherson that a drone had crashed into a bus again. Two people died in that bus. A young girl was completely torn in two. The mother tried to carry the child out. Well, child, she was over 18 years old and on her way to college just to enroll. They were attacked, and when the mother tried to carry her daughter out, she held only the upper torso in her hands. A truly horrific situation, and as casually as Maxim tells it, you just have to ensure you are constantly aware, constantly alert to what is happening around you, and you must have good reflexes because in those moments, just a few seconds decide whether people live or die. Step on the gas, look for cover, get the bus to the nearest shelter. Of course. First, you should accelerate, look for the largest available tree for cover, avoid moving in a straight line, or head to a shelter. Since the city has many shelters, a long escape is usually not necessary. The goal is to get people to the nearest shelter as quickly as possible. We must not forget that Maxim is not a soldier. Maxim is simply a bus driver, but a bus driver who has to talk about evasive maneuvers to avoid drones instead of timetables. And that is the bitter reality in this city where life somehow continues despite everything. One truly fascinating place in Kherson is the theater. The Kherson Theater is a massive building called the Mykola Kulish Theater. It used to be very well known in Ukraine because it regularly hosted international festivals. The theater had a highly renowned director, and we met his daughter right there in the building. This theater is also located in the Red Zone. It has been heavily damaged by countless attacks. The walls are covered in shrapnel scars. There are no windows left, only plywood panels. We met Oleksandra Kniha, who not only works at the theater but also volunteers with her family to support children.
Our theater building has been through a lot. It was built using the same design as the Mariupol Drama Theater. Currently, no performances take place here anymore. Most of our productions are now touring shows, performed in safer locations across the city and the region. Last year, we had 13 premieres. Most of them took place right here in Kherson, and we were very happy about that.
About the premiere she is speaking of, this theater is actually huge. We went inside, and it is a truly wonderful auditorium. It originally had seating for 600 people and was always very well attended before the Russian invasion. During the occupation, the Russians tried to force the conductor to work for them. He refused, and he was shot and killed in September 2022. Oleksandra's father, who was the director of this theater for many years, fled after being mistreated by the Russians for refusing to cooperate. Now they are back, and they hold these theater performances down in the basement. We went down there. It is a very small space, like a cabaret room, with maybe 60 or 70 seats. I don't remember exactly. They hold regular performances there. For me, this was another symbol of how these people refuse to let themselves be broken or defeated, and that culture keeps going. I found that deeply impressive because it shows how they try to live a normal life in Kherson despite everything.
We organize educational and cultural events, creative workshops, classes, and summer camps. We take children to the Carpathians and abroad so they can experience a safe environment and a peaceful sky and recover from the stress. Our goal is to give them unforgettable experiences and allow them to just be children.
To just be children is no longer given in Kherson, which is why that sentence is so powerful. Oleksandra also talks about the situation in the city itself.
There's constant shelling and drone attacks. And unfortunately, the situation is not improving. I've already suffered two concussions myself, one from artillery shelling and the other during a drone attack. Thank God I am alive and unharmed, and I continue to live and work in Kherson. But unfortunately, the situation is that people have to leave the city. We know and understand this, which is why we urgently plead for children to leave the city.
Staying and having to leave are both true at the same time in Kherson. Oleksandra stays to help children while simultaneously trying to get those exact children out of the city. You might remember an episode of our podcast, we will definitely link it in the show notes again, where we talked specifically about the children in Kherson. There are various places in the city where safe spaces have been built in basements for children to play and meet peers. Playing outside is life-threatening. There are videos published by the Russians themselves on their Telegram channels showing grenades being dropped from cargo or bomber drones onto playing children. It is highly dangerous for children to be outside, which is why these safe spaces exist in certain areas, allowing them to forget the madness of war for at least a few hours. We also visited a basement during our recent trip to Kherson a few days ago. It was a basement under a residential building in the red zone. In the evening, as dusk began to fall, several elderly people emerged from their apartments carrying their belongings and made their way down. It is a basement where they have spent every single night for a very long time, out of fear of Russian shelling and drones, simply to have a comparatively peaceful night. I met Lyudmila Rubanyak there. Lyudmila is a property manager responsible for 6 of the apartment blocks in that neighborhood. She acted as the manager and head of this basement. She used to work for the railway, and today she looks after these residential blocks. For nearly 3 years, she has spent her nights in this basement alongside other residents.
My name is Lyudmila. I am 64 years old, and we are in the city of Kherson, in a basement bunker. We began building this place in September 2023 because it saved us from shelling and continues to protect us to this day. When shelling occurs, we are not afraid down here.
When we arrived, you have to picture it. Old, large apartment blocks, 5 or 6 stories high, showing significant signs of age with peeling plaster, not a fancy neighborhood by any means. In front of the building with the basement shelter, there stood a large concrete wall, which I would estimate was about 2.5 meters high. The wall was designed to mitigate the blast waves if something hit the street. A few weeks prior, a mortar shell or some other projectile had reportedly landed right on that street. They weren't entirely sure what it was. We sat outside at first and talked for a bit. Lyudmila shared some things about herself, but then she noted that this area is essentially a drone highway. Just as she said that, we heard the sound of a drone overhead. These FPV drones sound like loud mosquitoes. As soon as that sound was heard, everyone headed down into the basement. It wasn't panicked, but the elderly residents simply said, "Now we have to go down, there's something in the air again and we need to get to the basement." Inside, it smelled heavily of mold. Rusty pipes ran along unplastered walls. On the table stood glasses, cups and tin cans filled with cigarette butts, illuminated by a bare bulb that cast a dim, pale light. It was certainly not a comfortable place. There were areas in the basement that were completely unfinished. There was a toilet in a truly dilapidated state, which I won't describe in detail. And then there were beds with very damp blankets and a dirty carpet on the floor. It wasn't a cozy environment, but it was a place where you are comparatively safe. Lyudmila described how she currently experiences the situation in Kherson.
Overall, it is very terrifying. We are being shelled, and they won't leave us in peace. Now drones are constantly circling above us, and it feels like being in a movie. They have turned it into a veritable safari, hunting for human beings. It is truly frightening.
Anyone traveling through Kherson immediately understands what she means. Aside from cities right on the front line, I have rarely experienced a city in Ukraine where the shelling is so intense and where something is constantly happening. You constantly hear the rattle of assault rifles in Kherson when mobile drone defense units become active. The danger is omnipresent, and what is truly staggering is this feeling of being deliberately hunted by Russian drone pilots. There is a very cynical term used for this, human safari. Every time I visit, I feel highly tense driving into the city because you know what you might encounter, and death or injury strikes entirely at random. As I mentioned, we now tape over our press vests to avoid being targeted, but we drive around in civilian vehicles, and at any moment a drone pilot might decide that our vehicle is a target to attack and destroy. When night fell, you could hear the mutual artillery duels truly begin. It gets incredibly loud when the so-called outgoings, the Ukrainian artillery fire, go out, and on the other side, the Russian artillery fire comes in. You can hear the explosions clearly, though inside the basement it all sounds very muffled, but you can tell that a lot is happening outside. That is exactly why Lyudmila and the others go down to this basement every single evening.
Well, we come here every evening. We feel calm here. And even during shooting or shelling, we are not afraid. This is a safe place.
Well, when a musty basement becomes the place where people find peace, I think that speaks volumes about the state of a city. Yes, when we left the bunker, the buses were running again, work was going on in the theater, children were playing in the street and riding their bicycles around the neighborhood. And in the evening, many people will return to that basement where we also spent the night. Perhaps that is the exact answer to the question from the beginning of this podcast. How does a city live under drones? By people simply keeping going. Bus drivers, theater makers, neighbors, not because they aren't afraid, but because someone has to keep daily life running. That was today's episode of our podcast In Crisis Mode. This podcast was produced by Alexander Baumeister. He is also a journalist and works for a radio station of the Funke Mediengruppe. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and follow us. That definitely helps make our work more visible. And feel free to write to me if you have a suggestion for one of our episodes, or if this question from Kirsten stays with you. What struck you most about the stories from Kirsten? You can reach us at chrisandmodus@funkemedien.de. Take care of yourselves. Until next time, bye.
Ein Podcast von Funke.